session number 16356, reel 3.
I was shown into this room, and a rather a large room, and there was a German officer sitting at a table which was open fronted, and I could see his boots, and they weren't very clean. So I thought, oh, you're a scruffy bloke. So he offered me a seat and a cigarette, and I said, I don't smoke. So he said, I'll ask you a few questions. So he started the usual number, rank and name, and then he wanted to know which squadron I was on and names of my crew and all kinds of questions which I thought were unnecessary, and I didn't answer them. So then he said, what was your route? And I said, I don't know. So he said, what do you mean you don't know? He said, what sort of person gets in an aeroplane and doesn't know where he's going? So I said, well, I don't know the route. So he said, oh. So this went on for a little while, and he said, well, turn round, and on the wall behind me was a big map, exactly the same as the one we'd had in our briefing room, exactly the same coloured ribbons showing you your initial routes, your turning points, and everything. And I said, well, what are you asking me for if you already know it? So he said, oh, well, that was that. So he kept on about who was in your crew, and I said, why do you want to know that? And he said, maybe they've been injured or they're dead and we can't identify them. And I said, well, everybody wears identity tags, so you don't need that. But what I didn't know was that they'd also shot down our wing commander that night, who was probably a little bit more important to them, and they were trying to find information. So he said, all right, I'll see you again. And I was then taken to a solitary cell where you had just a bed with some sort of steel lats springing, and covered with a mattress which was like a sack filled with paper and a pillow. And the guards in the corridor, they were two of them out there, and they used to talk to each other or crack jokes to each other, and they had horrible guttural laughs, and you were feeling a little bit humiliated in there. In order to go to the toilet, you had to rattle your latch on your door. So to get out of this room, you rattle the door latch, and he'd come along, and you say, what do you want? And by the way, they always stood to attention when they spoke to you. They seemed to respect your rank was more than theirs. And I said, I want to piss. So he said, 5 minutes. So we found out, or I found out, the only way to get out was to say you wanted to have a shit. So that got you then to the toilet. But the door was kept open, and he gave you one sheet of paper, and he just stood there watching you. So that wasn't fun. Then he came in with a glass with some stuff that smelt like disinfect to me. And I said, what's this? So he said, tea. And I smelled it, and I thought, this is poison, so I threw it at him. And he didn't retaliate. He just walked away, shut the door, walked away, and he came back with some more stuff in a glass, and he said, good English tea, milk, sugar. So I had a cup of tea. But I think the original stuff was probably mint tea. Then I got a visit from a chap who called himself the British Red Cross representative, and his name was Hughes, and he'd actually been shot down some while before us, and he defected to the other side. And of course he tells you all about, he's the British Red Cross representative and he wants information so that you, the information can go back home. And if you answer my questions, like, see, I'll give you a letter that you can write to send home. And because he came, all this business of crew's names and things. Well, he didn't get his answers, and unfortunately for him, somebody further along the corridor happened to be on the same squadron as him, and they knew him. So when we got eventually to the transit part of Dulagluft, there was a squadron leader, I think his name was Elliot. He was permanently at Dulagluft. They recognised him, and this was reported to the squadron leader, who was permanently at Dulagluft to supervise our transit to POW camps. And this squadron leader had a connection in some way back to England, and he got the message back that this fellow Hughes was doing this job. And at the end of the war, Hughes was brought back home, court-martialed at Uxbridge, I think. There was another American doing a similar job, an American major, and he was also trying to get information. We eventually came out of our solitary cells after I think about 4 days, and in the compound we had communal messing. All the Red Cross parcels were put into a kitchen, and we took turns at going in and cooking in the kitchen and serving it up on the table. The Americans thought we were their waiters. So they said, "Oi, oi boy, come here," you know. But we soon told them which way to go. Anyway, while I was there, I met my pilot, and it turned out that he had discovered he'd got my parachute when it didn't open. And he said he had to, when he pulled the ripcord, nothing happened. So he had to unpick the envelope and pull the parachute out manually.
In midair?
In midair. Eventually, I think it took quite a long time, about 10 days or so. Oh, we had a visit from the Luftwaffe, the airman to airman, you know, all friendly, cordial sort of visits. We were admiring their antelope skin coats, and very smart they were. Then eventually we had enough people to send to a camp, and we were loaded into cattle trucks. And our journey took 2 or 3 days to get from Frankfurt to Mühlberg, which was on the Elbe, in between Leipzig and Dresden. That wasn't a very pleasant journey, because you were all herded into these trucks, and it was winter time. Occasionally you stopped for do your toilets at the side of the train and to get a little bit of soup. And then we arrived at Mühlberg and were taken into the camp, and there they photographed us and gave you a I think we got our prisoner of war number there, and they took your thumbprints and gave you the injections and inoculations and x-rays and a haircut. And the haircutting was done by two Russian prisoners, one turning the handle and the other one operating the sheep shearing clippers. So we're all shorn off, we're completely hairless. And only one chap avoided this, and he was a Norwegian who somehow or other got a woolly hat from somewhere, and he put his hat on, pulled it down by his ears, and they thought they'd already cut his hair. And he was probably the only chap who managed to get away from the camp because he had some hair and he could speak the language, and we think he got home.
So this was a transit camp, was it, Mulberry?
No, that was a permanent camp, and it was basically an army camp. There was probably about 20,000 prisoners of war in there. Many, many nationalities. There were Serbs and Croats, and they were fighting each other then. Americans and Frenchmen, Dutchmen, Poles, all kinds. But the RAF had a compound in the middle of the camp. We were in a camp within the camp. We were closed in a sort of miniature camp inside the army camp. And we had paratroops, SAS and RAF air crew all in this compound. And the idea was that they penned up the people who they thought were probably most likely to cause them any trouble. Each one of our huts had about 200 people in it, and you had your own barrack chef, as they called him, the barrack chief. In our case, he was a sergeant major from the SAS, who was quite a ruthless character himself. He had three tier bunks that were two abreast, meaning that you got six people in a group for your sleeping accommodation. And these bunks had side rails and planks of wood going across them. Each bunk had about 14 planks of wood. That was your spring of your bed, and you just had a blanket on that to lay on. There was a central position fire with a horizontal flue with hot plates, steel hot plates on top, so that you had quite a small fire in the fire unit, but the hot gases that led along this horizontal flue to the chimney, you were able to cook things on top of the hot plate. You had to make your own plates and cups. We made them out of tin cans. By folding the tin cans, you made a plate. The fuel ration was very minimal, and people created things which we called blowers. You geared up an impeller and caused a draft, so you could just get an ember of fuel and you could boil up your pot, Dixie, or boil it up on top. When we first went there, we got Red Cross parcels fairly regularly, probably one a week. And we, at that time, thought the guards were there to keep the civilians out, because we knew they weren't getting as much food in their German rations as we were getting in the Red Cross parcels. But after the second front opened up in Normandy, then we didn't get anything because no trains could move in Germany, they get shot off the lines. So we were down, after that period, we were down to basic German rations, which was just like a mug of soup at midday and a couple of slices of bread. Occasionally you've got some so-called butter and sugar and jam, which was all produced out of coal apparently, so that in the end you finished up with briquettes for your fire, which was made of the coal dust. As we were short of fuel, our SAS chappie in charge, he decided that the French kitchen had got too much coal and that we ought to have some of it. So he went out one night, made an impression of the lock on their door, came back, made a key, and then took half a dozen of us out with sacks to bring back the coal. And we put it all up in the roof of our hut. And they couldn't find this coal for ages. And eventually something happened, a board came loose in the roof and a bit of this coal fell out just at the time when one of the German guards, who was a sort of senior sergeant called an Oberfeldwebel, he was coming along looking for tunnels and he spotted this coal come out of the ceiling. So he had a good idea that we should carry it back to the French kitchen in galvanised iron type baths, you know, like little kids used to bath in. So we carried it out of one door and this SAS bloke was seeing it back in through the other door, and we didn't lose any coal at all. Then we had a chap who was able to speak Russian, and in another little compound they got some Russian officers penned up. And one day he brings one of these officers back with him, and his name was Vasil Kaspinsky, and Vasil was for Basil, so we called him Basil. The bunk underneath me, I was on the middle of the three-tier bunks, the bunk under me was empty, so Basil had the bunk under me. Now the Germans are looking for him, he's escaped. They're looking for him outside. But of course he hasn't left the camp yet. And the idea was that we would feed him up and get him ready for his escape bid. He was a professor of art at Moscow University. So we got him some paints, bribed the guards for paints and paper, and he actually done some pictures for us, and I've got some with me that he did from my fiancée's photograph and one of me as I was, which I will show you later on. So Basil, if any of our chaps attempted to escape, Basil was put on parade to make the number up. Other than that, we hid him. So if one of our chaps decided to try and make a break for it, we had Basil out to make the number up. And then after a couple of days, we tell the Germans that someone's missing. See? Give them a leg start. He got so proficient with our language, he didn't know any English when he came to us. We had an SS search one day and he was interviewed by an SS officer and got away with it. So eventually he went and we never heard whether he was successful or not. We had several blokes tried escape attempts, but no one was ever successful. We were about 600 miles from home and we were right in the middle of Germany, and if you couldn't speak the language, it was not much good. A brilliant idea a chap had was all the cans that we had from the Red Cross, after we'd finished with them, we had to take them to a dump which was outside our toilet. All these cans were stacked up against the wall of the brick-built toilet. The toilet was a dry sump where about 30-odd chaps could sit down at a communal crap and discuss the news of the day. Eventually this became full up and the liquid overflowed and came out through all these tins. But the Russian prisoners used to come and scrape our tins out, and the Italians, when they turned over, you know, when they ceased to be allies of the Germans, they were then treated the same as the Russians. They were treated horribly, and they used to scrape these tins out with all our liquid from our toilet running through them. When there were enough tins against the wall of this thing, they were loaded onto a hand cart and taken down to a factory in the village to be compressed. So one of our members of our hut, he decided that if we covered him with a sheet, he could lay in the bottom of this truck, put the tins on top of him, and when they got to the factory yard, he would get out and hide in a manhole. Well, this he did, and he thought quite successfully until he looked up. But one of the guards had noticed him go down the manhole, so he was standing there with him, and they brought him back in. And every time the truck went down to the factory after that, it had bayonets pushed down through all the tins to make sure nobody else was hiding in there. We told the Germans that we needed a recreation hut, and where the padre and the doctor and everybody could have a room, and we could have further education, people could give lessons and all this. So they agreed to that, and this hut was built. And because it was sandy in that area where we were, all the buildings were built on brick piers, and the hut was about 2 feet off the ground. From the floor of the padre's room, they cut a hole and a tunnel was started in the ground under the padre's room. And we all had to give up some of our bed boards. I told you we had 14 boards. So we finished up with probably about 8 boards each instead of 14. And the idea was to shore up the tunnel with these boards. And the sand that came out of the tunnel was spread out underneath this hut. And the Germans didn't notice that the hut was level with the ground after a while. And everything was going nicely, and the hut was getting near the surface outside the wire, when the German farmer decided to plough his field, and going along with the plough, and it fell down the hole, which was just below the surface at that time. So the commandant had a brilliant idea. See, the dry sump lavatory I told you about had to be emptied by the Russian prisoners, and it was pumped from the sump of the toilet into long barrel carts called Scheisen carts, and they were taken out to the farms. So there were 3 of these carts ready to go out, so the commandant decided that they should be poured down the hole of the tunnel. He said, "You won't use that anymore, will you?" So that was another ruse we had. We had several people who were able to entertain us, so they had talent and they used to put on shows for us. And we had a theatre, which we paid two cigarettes for admission. And all their costumes and furniture and everything was made from Red Cross parcels, materials and string. And we had a very good theatre, we thought. And our commandant at the time was in the Africa Corps, and he was a swanky little chap, but he was very good to us. If if people escaped, he had to punish them. He had to give them 10 days solitary confinement, and he gave them a certificate to say that they served this solitary confinement for attempting to escape. He suddenly disappeared, and he was replaced by an SS colonel. So we thought, oh, now we're in trouble, you see. But we'd got a new show just beginning to come on, so the German officers were invited. They sat in the front row, and when the show had finished, this commandant, the new one, he said, well, it was very good, but the theatre is not good enough. He said, tomorrow we'll get a truck, we'll go to Leipzig Opera House, you get all the stage props you need, and we'll have concrete brought in, and you get a sloping floor. Previously we'd had a flat floor, you see, so if you were at the back you didn't get a very good view. So we thought, well, it's not bad, this SS chappy giving us this. So anyway, that was quite good. And then when the second front opened, the commandant came round to each hut and told us that our allies had landed on the coast of Normandy. He said, but we'll have them back in the sea by lunchtime. He said, go back to your huts, get your breakfast, get your eggs and bacon and everything. So, for a nice little joke on his part. So anyway, the SAS chappie we had, he produced a map of the new front, because we had a radio set. We were getting the BBC news every day, and he put on this map where all the armies were, the various armies, little flags went on, and the German guards used to come in and see how the war was going on our map, because their information was about 3 days old when they got it. And one of our sort of friendly guards, he was a very tall chap with huge boots, and we called him the Obergefreutner mit der Graf Boot. And he came in on the same day as this invasion started on Normandy, and he said, cheerio lads. He said, where are you going then? He said, I volunteer for the West Front. As soon as I get there, he said, I shall give myself up. I'll be in England next week, roast beef, Yorkshire pudding.
So they knew that you were listening into an illegal radio?
Oh yeah, but they couldn't find it. I mean, we didn't know where it was. We just had the benefit of people coming round giving us the news. It was powered by German cycle lamp batteries. The camp was so huge that the guards went around on bikes. And when they visited your hut, they left their bike outside and they lost the battery. So there were about a dozen batteries harnessed up to power the radio. But the guards always tipped us off when we were going to be searched by the SS, so that the radio was dismantled, and they never did find it. We had a chap there who was a newsreel cameraman, basically, and he was flying in a Boston bomber as an RAF sergeant, although he was a civilian. Terry Hunt, his name was, and he somehow or other got a camera, bribed a guard and got a camera, and he carried it around the camp in a big book. He'd cut out the front of this book and got his camera lens shining, and he used to walk around with his book taking photographs in the camp. So somewhere there's a collection of those photographs by Terry Hunt. He, along with lots of celebrities, used to come around lecturing us in the evening.